Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the governor extends phase two coronavirus restrictions to September 11th. Many businesses see this as a major blow. Meanwhile, Mecklenburg County deliberates on how to help businesses comply with the governor's mask mandate. We are inching closer to the Republican convention in Charlotte. Parts of it are here, but where will the president make his acceptance speech? And Hurricane Isaias hits the coast. We get a wrap-up of the damage. And here to update us on all that and much more is WFAE's political reporter, Steve Harrison. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta is here. She's senior editor for Charlotte Agenda. Thank you for joining us.
Morning.
Glenn Berkins is founder, publisher of QCityMetro.com. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg, who guest hosted this program just yesterday. You can't get rid of him. He's back.
the bad penny returns.
That's right. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for coming back, Eric. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. We're all on the radio. We're also on Facebook Live. We're going to begin with a story that I did not billboard there because this came in late yesterday afternoon. More than a week ago, Charlotte City Council decided to bar Carolina FinTech Hub, it's a nonprofit run by City Council member Tariq Bakari, over concerns that Bakari could potentially benefit from taxpayer dollars or create the appearance of a conflict of interest. He would have run this, Eric, as I understand it, but not necessarily profited from it. And according to, he says he's completely innocent of this. So what was exactly going on there?
Yeah, it's really entangled, but this came up in a committee meeting. It was soon after Tariq Bakari had criticized most of the council for not supporting the police. And so he thought it was a personal attack. The council wound up, as you say, excluding the Carolina FinTech Hub from this workforce program. The payment that was involved would have gone directly to trainees from the city. So it would not have gone through Carolina FinTech, but Carolina FinTech was going to run this program. The city attorney said that he had found no evidence of a conflict of interest violation, but council members were concerned that it just didn't look right, and they have decided to essentially revise the policy at some point. So that's where we were a week or so ago, and now I think, as you're about to mention, we have some more developments.
Yes. So they dropped Carolina FinTech Hub from participating in that program to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest. So now Republicans, the state GOP, has filed ethics complaints against two Democrats on Charlotte City Council. The council members are Dimple Ashmera and James Mitchell. Why them?
Well, they are members of this committee. Dimple Ashmera, in particular, was aggressive in questioning what Carolina FinTech Hub was doing and whether they would benefit. The interesting part, and everyone here today, of course, has covered a lot of politics. The interesting part here is that everyone says, and when I say everyone, Dimple Ashmera, James Mitchell, and Tariq Bakari have pretty consistently said, none of this is personal. But then on the other hand, there have been times where they thought they were being accused of things or attacked. I have not seen a response yet from Ashmera and Mitchell about what was alleged yesterday. So we'll have to wait to hear that. But yeah, it's a mess. And we're, 3 months from Election Day, I think. You know, you can see what's going on here.
So the state GOP spokesman, Tom Wiginton, says the attacks against Tariq Bakari were politically motivated because of his frequent clashes with colleagues over, police reform and the GOP convention, because he's been a proponent of having that convention in Charlotte. Could it be said, then, that these complaints from the state GOP are directly in retaliation for Ashmera and Mitchell raising concerns over the conflict of interest on Bakari's part with regard to the FinTech Hub situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people outside of this who are not directly involved are going to naturally assume that a lot of this is about politics. Now, of course, we don't know what will be found. There could be things out there. But it certainly seems like we have a bit of a rivalry going on here, back and forth. And as you said, the NCGOP is talking about Tart Bakary in terms of what he said supporting the police, and whether some of his colleagues were retaliating in a sense with the questions about the FinTech Hub. So there's a lot to be sorted out here.
One more question. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think it's interesting that that the state Republican Party weighed in with this ethics complaints, because really for so many years, there really is no Republican Party in Charlotte city politics. You know, there's a 9-2 council majority, and the two Republicans occasionally make some points and lose a lot of votes. And it was just a bit of a surprise to see the state weighing in on this when they are such small players locally in Charlotte politics.
But go ahead.
Yeah,
and just kind of continuing that theme, as Eric said, we don't know what's going to come out of this, so we certainly don't want to prejudge it. But I remember when I came to Charlotte and I started talking about partisan politics on city council, and someone said, there are no partisan politics on city council. So to a lot of, and I've noticed as well in my 20 years here, that there might be kind of personality conflicts, but city council has never been particularly partisan. And I wonder if this is the start of seeing that change.
Very quickly, Dimple Ajmera was not the only person on the small business panel that raised questions about Tariq's involvement. So Julie Eisel, the mayor pro tem, also did the same. So, and so did several business owners who were on that panel. So why target Dimple and Smudgy Mitchell?
I think Smudgy was targeted, or maybe let me back off the word targeted, but was part of the ethics complaint, because he took a trip several years ago to Detroit, a taxpayer funded trip, to look at the new football stadium that the Lions had built. And the idea was this was to help him an educational trip, because the Panthers were considering something similar. And I think a lot of reasonable people could look at that trip and say, was that really necessary? Dimple Ajmera was part of it. I believe the complaint was that there were rezoning votes coming up, and that developers had given her campaign contributions before those votes. I think we've all covered enough city council votes to know that the timing may be a little unusual, but developers bankroll city council campaigns. They're the big players.
So we will keep our eye on that story and see what, if anything, develops from it as we go into the next couple of weeks. For those looking for a quicker reopening to our economy, we got some disappointing news this week in North Carolina from Governor Roy Cooper.
We've stabilized at a number that's too high. We've stabilized at a percent positive that is too high. So we want to continue to work to drive those numbers down. And we think that staying safer in home phase two will help us do that.
And with that, the governor extended phase two restrictions for the third time, this time through September 11th. 5 more weeks. This will take us through the Republican convention and through the Labor Day weekend. And this is a longer extension of phase two this time. The other two extensions were for 3 weeks. This was 5. So what does that tell us?
Well, the governor and Mandy Cohen, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, both said that with back to school, even as limited as it may be, that is a significant change. That's a concern. They want to watch those trends. And then, of course, you also have the colleges going back. And so there is the risk of virus spread from that perspective as well. So it's all about back to school and seeing how those trends go before they consider looking at a further relaxing of the reopening plan.
Well, CMS, of course, has decided to go online only in this semester, but other school districts around the state have made different decisions, either hybrid decisions or opening the doors to classroom altogether. How does this extension of phase two statewide impact those school decisions elsewhere? Or does it?
I think it's still, I mean, for schools, this doesn't impact them. They are still able to move forward with whatever plan they'd settled on. But I think going back to what Eric said, I think we're in 5 weeks because I think pretty much everyone expects that this period of stability or decline in coronavirus cases probably is going to run out when colleges go back.
Yes, and it seems to me to be counterintuitive. I mean, if you're going to extend phase two and make business owners stay closed, particularly bars and restaurants and other places that they're prohibiting from reopening, why would you allow colleges to bring kids back to school dorms and open classrooms at various public and private schools around the state, including universities and colleges, when you're trying to get a handle on this thing? This seems to be counterproductive, at the very least.
I think there are a lot of questions about consistency of what needs to remain closed and what is allowed to remain open in terms of universities, elementary schools, you know, breweries can reopen, but bars cannot, for instance. Yeah. That's a major question. But I was going to say, many universities across the state are opting for completely virtual learning for at least the fall semester, while at the same time, you know, University of North Carolina is back on campus. There are already videos circulating of a sorority rush party that, you know, some neighbors. So I think that this all raises questions of, you know, how consistently are we being with reopening and what makes sense and what doesn't. But undoubtedly, the return to campus and the return to classrooms among some institutions will result in a case spike without other things like gyms and bars reopening.
And this consistent inconsistency at all levels of government seems to be undermining public confidence. You don't know what to believe. They seem to change the rules on a whim at any given moment in time. And the rules, when they're in place, are contradictory. So why should you believe any of it, which raises the frustration level? Phase two has limited indoor gatherings to 10 people and severely impacted, as you mentioned, Katie, bars and restaurants and gyms under phase two, nightclubs, theaters, music venues also remain closed. Many business owners are exasperated and asking, when will this end? Like Michelle Laurie, who spoke with WCNC-TV.
Why do we have to pay the price for everything? Nobody else is picking and choosing who's going to be a winner. It's cherry picking. So why are you making private bars suffer?
She and her husband own Jeff's Bucket Shop on Montfort Drive. They don't serve food, so they have to stay closed under phase two. Is her reaction the common one, Katie? You talk to business people, so do you, Eric. Is hers the common one among bar and restaurant owners?
Go ahead, Katie.
I was going to say, I think there's certainly a frustration that, you know, this policy is uneven. And if bars and gyms need to remain closed, what can governments telling them to remain closed do to assist them at this time? And I think that that's a real frustration because, you know, the Paycheck Protection Program, for instance, wasn't a fix-all. It wasn't a Band-Aid for everybody. Not everybody could get it. And not everyone is able to hire everyone back if they can't reopen or can't reopen at full capacity. So there's a lot of frustration about, you know, how do you survive for months on end without incoming revenue? How do you pay your rent on time? What's the rationale for, you know, some businesses that technically aren't allowed to reopen continuing to do so with basically with impunity? So I know that that has caused a great deal of frustration, understandably. You know, while a lot of these guys do favor, you know, safety and keeping their patrons as healthy and safe as possible, they still, you know, would say that they have a plan in mind and they, you know, they can operate as safely as possible, just like breweries can, for instance. So we do sense a lot of frustration right now and it's completely understandable.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get to governor.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, what's interesting about it, Mike, is there are plenty of good arguments, and I hear the same ones that Katie just laid out for us. There are plenty of good arguments of why various businesses should be open, can be open, and how safe it could be, but the cases keep going up.
That's Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Katie Peralta from Charlotte Agenda, Glenn Burkins from Q-City Metro, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Steve Harrison, Katie Peralta, Eric Spanberg, Glenn Burkins. Governor Cooper was asked recently about, because restaurants and brew pubs seem to be handling rules effectively, why not let bars open but with safety restrictions?
We have seen what has happened in other states when bars have been opened. Governor Abbott of Texas said that in all of his reopening, the thing that he regrets the most was reopening bars. We know that these are high transmission areas, and that's why that they have remained closed. And one of the reasons we did put the alcohol curfew in place at 11 o'clock is because we were getting information about restaurants turning into bars after hours.
So are bars any more convivial than restaurants? Do they seem to lend themselves to lowered inhibitions? Is that the thinking here, that because you're consuming alcohol in a bar, you're probably going to be closer than you normally would, et cetera? Is that what's going on here? And why isn't that, why isn't that the same at a brew pub?
That's the argument, what you just said. Dr. Anthony Fauci and plenty of others have said, because of the lessened inhibitions, the tendency for it to be very loud, whether it's music or anything else, and people are having to speak louder and be closer to each other, that bars are a place where it's likely to have a lot of virus spread. The argument, I'm going to ask Katie to help me out. The argument for breweries, is it because they make it on site? Is that how they're able to be open? I can't remember what the specific reason is.
There are a number of reasons that their lobbying body pointed to. They have really detailed safety plans in place for reopening, and that they could space out tables. A lot of them did away with like waiting in lines. So you have basically table service, which, you know, helps in kind of spreading people out a little bit more. Many of them do have either restaurant or kitchens inside, or they have food trucks. I'm not quite sure I fully understand the food thing. I guess maybe their argument might be that if you're eating, you're not going to get as intoxicated, maybe. But I think that the real difference is also breweries are not open as late as a traditional bar is. And in that regard, you're not going to have people, you know, packed in on a dance floor and shouting over one another. A lot of the times breweries also have space outdoors, which, you know, as we all know, being outside reduces chances of spread pretty significantly too.
So a moment ago, we heard from Michelle Lowry from Jeff's Bucket Shop on Montford. She criticized the current policy for, quote, cherry picking winners and losers by choosing who can open and who cannot. And I mused out loud, does it make any sense to prevent them from opening if you're going to bring schools back into session and you're going to let kids go into the dorms at colleges and universities? And the health director of Orange County told UNC Chapel Hill's chancellor she would like them to postpone in-person instruction for at least 5 weeks and would really prefer virtual learning for the entire fall semester. Did that fall on deaf ears in Chapel Hill? Obviously so. Okay. Mecklenburg County's health director, Gibby Harris, made a similar request to any of the colleges or universities, including CPCC here in Charlotte?
I've not heard Gibby Harris say that on any of the briefings that I've been on.
You know, and Mike, I was going to say one more thing, going back to phase two. You know, if we go back to May, when the state laid out the big four metrics, you know, we get the green check or the red X or the yellow line. And, you know, the big thing was kind of stable or declining. And so I think if you're a bar owner, a small business owner, you could look at the most recent data and you could make a very good case that there should be four green checks. And so I think that there is a bit of a frustration with, they feel like it may be the correct decision, but the goalposts have been moved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think one more thing too, we talk about bars, and bars is a really big deal, but what about museums, outdoor playgrounds? These are some things maybe that could be opened and really have no impact on spread, but still closed.
Well, in the last,
and meanwhile, you have camps and pools and things like that open, particularly to your playground point, Steve. How can you have an overnight camp or a day camp open, but you can't have a playground? And that is to your point as well, Mike, that there's so many contradictions and conflicts in these policies that it gets very confusing.
So in the last,
that's exactly how this has become such a crazy political issue as well. We don't understand this virus. And I think that as they're continuing to learn more, these guidelines change and they shift, and that really shakes confidence in public officials. I remember back in like March, they were telling everybody not to wear face masks because they wanted to preserve those N95 masks specifically for healthcare workers. And now all we're hearing is, you know, wear a mask, it helps to prevent the spread. So I think that sort of this evolving message, let's call it evolving, let's not call it contradictory, really is hard. It's hard for the public to maintain confidence in leadership when all of this is sort of shifting.
So in the last several weeks, additional requirements have become part of these phase two restrictions, including mask wearing and the alcohol curfews at restaurants after 11 p.m. Are they having the impact that health officials had hoped for, or do we know?
I don't know if we can draw a conclusion yet. The governor said the other day during his briefing that he attributed some of the stabilization to the fact that people are wearing masks and expects some similar results from the alcohol curfew. Now, obviously, it's in their interest to say that. I will say anecdotally, I do see a lot more people wearing masks. So assuming that the science is right, and I have to assume that, then there probably is some impact. The question, though, is how long will this, obviously the question is, how long will this stabilization last, or will it start to go up? Because remember, even with the glimmer of good news the other day, everyone agrees that North Carolina is still elevated. I mean, it's not like we've had a downward trend for any sustained period.
And I think if you look at some of the charts, and even in some of the states where we're seeing some of the most rapid spread, we're starting to see what I'm hoping are promising signs of the case count starting to plateau and even decline a little. And that certainly correlates or corresponds with governors in that state imposing more restrictions, shutting down bars, more people wearing masks. As Eric said, anecdotally, I think there is plenty of anecdotal evidence that masks and shutting down public gatherings, those types of things are starting to have an impact.
And of course, it's not just bars and restaurants. Gyms like Gina Hamilton's Ride or Die Spin Studio on Clanton Road are also closed.
I don't know how anyone's going to survive much longer. Give us some sort of wiggle room, something, anything.
Gina Hamilton speaking with WCNC-TV. Did the governor say why it was okay for schools to open but not for gyms to open?
I don't think he made that comparison directly, but they have said multiple times that gyms are a really tricky area because people are breathing heavily. There's a high likelihood for transmission if you're in a closer room, especially like a spin studio, for transmission. So again, it comes back to what's fair and what's not. Some private spin studios might be able to safely space everyone out and put plexiglass up, but I'm not sure the state would have the ability to say, okay, this studio can open up, but this larger one can't. So it's sort of, unfortunately, this one size fits all policy.
And I think, Mike, we have to acknowledge as well that we can't fairly compare schools to bars. Parents need schools open in order to work. They need to work in order to earn money. They need to earn money in order to keep the economy going. So it's a vicious cycle. I don't think anyone would argue that they're being even-handed across the board. I think whether it's North Carolina or other states, they're making the best decisions they can while trying to have the least impact on the economy, least harmful impact on the economy.
So Chris Narveson, who is the owner of Orange Theory Fitness, told the Charlotte Observer there has been no guidance or compassion given to businesses that are forced to be closed under the governor's authoritarian executive order. Those are his words. Are bar owners and gym owners not being given any special assistance from either the state or federal governments during this crisis? Nothing
special in particular. I mean, both the county and the city have small business grant and loan opportunities that they could tap into, as well as the federal government's PPP. But there's nothing specifically spelled out for these two types of businesses.
So, Eric, the Business Journal has been conducting an unscientific reader poll, which asks if readers think North Carolina should be fully open by now, or if we're moving at just the right speed and are balancing public health and economic needs, or if we are moving too fast. You just push buttons on the website to answer those questions. So what are you seeing? What results are you getting?
I hope you have those results in front of you, because I do not have the results in front
as of
me,
yesterday, you can always count up, I'm a lawyer. I have the answers to every question that I ask. So as of yesterday at 3 p.m., 55% think that we're moving too slow in reopening, 39% believe we're doing it just right, 6% believe we should return to tighter restrictions. Now, this is just from people who have chosen to answer this survey, so it's completely unscientific. But that's, I think that probably matches sentiment, don't you?
And what I was going to say is, while I cannot, could not recall the exact numbers by any means, what, much like Katie said, when you speak to business owners, they are almost uniformly frustrated because, and you played the clip of the woman that owns the spin class business. What are you supposed to do when you own a business and you're either restricted or shut down all the way and you can't wait? I mean, there are only so many PPP programs and grant programs. And even if you get that, that's 8 weeks, 12 weeks. Remember, we're almost 5 months into this and there's no end in sight. So yeah, business owners are just terribly frustrated. Then when you throw in the evolving information, as you describe it, Katie, it just becomes overwhelming, because all that time you're just thinking about, I have to pay rent, I have to pay utilities, I have workers, or I have to lay off workers. And it's just kind of a vicious cycle.
So, Glenn, this is also impacting the criminal justice system. Evidently, we haven't had a criminal trial in Mecklenburg County since March. And Spencer Merriweather, the district attorney, says this is going to send them into a bit of a tizzy. Talk about that.
I think he would say they're already into a bit of a tizzy. As you point out, it's been 5 months since they've convened a jury trial, and all the while, crime continues unabated. As we all know, homicides are up. Some categories of violent crimes are up. I talked with the DA yesterday. He was saying that no one should be surprised that at some point, he may have to look at entire classes of offenses and figure out how to deal with this, because there's just a growing backlog in the courts right now. Even things like the protesters from earlier this year, dozens of people were arrested with no trial dates set. I think he said that in a million years, when this year started, he could not have imagined finding himself in this situation.
There's no way to do a jury trial. I mean, can't you find a way to separate the jurors so they don't have to sit side by side by side during a trial and still protect people and still do a trial? You can't do that. So they're sending kids back to school. Why can't you have trials?
Well, we did talk about that a little, and he actually compared it to sending kids back to school. Not only do you have to have the jurors in the courtroom,
right,
but you have to convene, I think he said, 71 people for the jury pool. They're in that room together during deliberations. Whoever is picked for the jury is in an even smaller room deliberating. He said that they've done as much as they can to make the court system safe, but right now, he just has no idea when they will start seating juries again.
And health officials keep saying, this is why you should wear a mask, because health officials keep saying, as long as you don't wear a mask, the virus is going to spread and the economy is going to be shut down. And so is the criminal court system. And so are the schools. And it just balloons out from there. So this week, I'm told, Mecklenburg County has been investigating ways to help people cooperate with the governor's mask wearing mandate. You're supposed to wear a mask into retail stores and places like that, but some retail stores don't want to put their employees in the position of having to enforce that. We talked about this in the past. We don't have to belabor that. So what is the county considering doing?
The county manager mentioned this the other day during a briefing, and she had gotten this, it was from the Business Roundtable. She mentioned that this idea had been used in Las Vegas and in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, which is Pittsburgh is the county seat, having ambassadors go out and in essence encourage and educate business owners on getting people to wear masks. I mean, it's that simple. Now, the board talked about it the next night. They have not set a definite time frame for doing this yet, but it sounds like it's something they're going to pursue.
So these would be bilingual people going out to talk to business owners, not to customers in the stores, to business owners?
I assume they could talk to anybody they want, but the more efficient way, obviously, is to deal with the business owners who are dealing face-to-face with a number of customers.
And Kelly,
the other thing is they want to make sure that they're educating people before going immediately to punishment, because right. I think there's a concern among among county officials, at least, that there are, you know, there's perhaps misunderstanding about what the policy should be, how to apply them for customers coming in. So I think that it's primarily an education first component before they go directly to citations and things like that.
And Eric, you wrote that Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris said that the Count On Me CLT campaign and other steps taken by government and business to limit the spread of this virus remain crucial for reducing the impact of the pandemic. What is the Count On Me CLT campaign?
It's a couple of ad agencies in town have put together this $200,000 campaign that is essentially emphasizing what we've talked about a zillion times here and everywhere else, which is the three W's of wearing your mask and maintaining 6 feet, washing your hands, the basic hygiene, and the message of everybody participating so that we can end this pandemic sooner, not only primarily for health reasons, but also so that we can get back to normal life with schools and all the other things that we're talking about. And the county has another $500,000 in federal money that they will at least partially dedicate to getting this word out in various ways through advertising and other grassroots efforts.
And the Observer reported this week that modest improvement or stable coronavirus trends are beginning to emerge here in Charlotte and surrounding communities. That's a new development. And this week, the governor also stressed that stability is fragile. And we've seen that in other parts of the country where it looks like they got a handle on things and suddenly they don't. When we come back, we'll talk about the impact of this on the on fall school sports, the jumble of activity going on surrounding the Republican National Convention. And believe it or not, there was a hurricane earlier this week that caused some damage down east. We'll get an update on that as well. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News, Katie Peralta from Charlotte Agenda, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We've talked several times and at length prior to CMS's decision to conduct the fall semester exclusively online about how worried some teachers were about returning to the classroom for health reasons. And now veteran teacher Erlene Lied, who is also former head of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Association of Educators, has told WFAE News that there's still a lot of anxiety about going back into schools just to prepare for the all-remote year that's coming up.
The concern is with the ventilation systems in the old schools, you've got that virus still just circulating. I feel better if they bring in some engineers and go through these schools and certify them. And look at the airflow and say, well, this building is really not safe.
So has CMS responded to those concerns? Because they went back yesterday. The teachers went back yesterday into those buildings. Have they responded? Do we know?
We don't know. About that one.
Okay.
I think they haven't addressed that particular issue. And I think the other thing that I'm curious about as a parent is, you know, it's been about 3 weeks now that there was an idea we were going to set, or CMS was going to set a metric or a series of metrics to go back. There was talk about creating a health advisory group. And I don't think either of those have happened yet. And I think a lot of parents are just kind of watching and waiting to see what is the What's the benchmark? What is going to bring kids back?
Because more than 9,000 teachers at CMS went back to the school buildings yesterday to prepare for the start of school, which will be entirely online. So why do teachers have to go back into their buildings to make those preparations? Why can't they be virtual as well?
That's a good question. I really don't know the answer. I mean, I've seen CMS saying that they want teachers in the classrooms and doing the remote learning at least for the first month from schools and encouraging them to stay there afterwards. But I don't know why that is, you know, other than maybe the setting, you know, that the kids see an actual classroom. I don't know. I'm just grasping for an answer.
So yesterday, 66 NFL players announced they're going to sit out the football season. The Major League Baseball season has been trying its best to get underway, but they keep shutting some teams down because virus is spreading through those teams. Some universities have canceled their football schedules for the year. What impact is this having on high school sports, football and otherwise?
So it looks like based on what CMS, the way CMS answered a survey from the State High School Athletic Association, they're not going to have any sports as long as remote learning is in place. And obviously remote learning is in place for the foreseeable future. So you're hearing rumblings about would they maybe move football and other sports to January or February or the spring. That's a possibility. And you're also hearing, not surprisingly, from some football coaches who are frustrated and other coaches that they can't even practice right now. So, but as you said, Mike, there are so many examples of sports leagues and teams having trouble with virus spread. You can see how this is not an easy thing to figure out.
Well, the North Carolina High School Athletic Association's target date to start fall sports practice had been moved to September the 1st, which is later than it normally is because a lot of schools have already been playing football by that time in a normal school year. If they go back and actually practice in some of these school districts where they're not completely virtual, When will the games start? Who will they play when some of the schools have been taken off the schedule? How will that work? Does anybody know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, you can even see it at the highest levels where, let's take your baseball example. You have teams that are essentially playing in geographic zones rather than playing all over the country as they normally do. So everything is having to be redone on the fly, college sports, high school sports. And sorting all this out is why we have the mess that we have. So you're asking a very good question that does not have an answer as of yet.
And I think I was just going to say the idea of redoing things on the fly. I think most people would agree that high school football in the fall is going to be really hard to do, just like wrestling is going to be very difficult as a winter sport. But cross country, golf, and tennis are three high school sports that if you were going to try and do sports in the fall, those would be, I think, the ones to try, that you could socially distance, you could do them safely. And I think, and I just haven't heard any kind of talk about, well, let's maybe try this and not this. It's just a complete shutdown.
So before we move on to the Republican National Convention, Andos Helms, WFAE's education reporter, reported yesterday that two schools did not reopen for teachers yesterday because of COVID cases. Hawthorne Academy of Sciences and Walter G. Byers K-8 school. CMS told employees there to work remotely, quote, while the facilities were cleaned and disinfected due to a positive COVID case in those facilities. That's how tenuous all of this is. So we're just weeks away from the Republican National Convention, such as it is here in Charlotte. And this week, the Republican National Committee released its health plan for this business-only convention in Charlotte. Does anybody know the details of that plan? They seem to be being held pretty close to the vest.
They put out a release, the RNC did, summarizing their plan, saying that they will stay 6 feet apart. They will wear masks. They talked about temperature checks. But the big thing is, the big difference is agreeing to wear masks and be socially distant. Because back in June, when we were still inside the arena for the convention, that was what they would not agree to do.
And now, the first edition of the Local News Roundups.
Where in the world is
Donald Trump's speech?
Yep, as circumstances continue to change, with the Republican convention, so does our Republican National Convention update theme. This one is very specific, so let's hear it again.
Where in the world is
Donald Trump's speech?
Yep, where indeed. Last week, the president asked, anybody have any ideas on where to hold his renomination acceptance speech? This week, he told Fox and Friends he would probably do it from the White House.
It would be the easiest from the standpoint of security. You know, they move with a lot of people. It's a very expensive operation militarily and law enforcement-wise. The Secret Service is fantastic. But, you know, it's a big deal. And we're thinking about doing it from the White House because there's no movement. It's easy, and I think it's a beautiful setting.
But there are some serious questions surrounding the legality of that. His idea raised questions about violating the Hatch Act, which restricts political activity on government grounds and by government employees. And Trump says he has a loophole to that. Him.
Well, it is legal. There is no Hatch Act because it doesn't pertain to the president.
First, Steve, is that true?
What I've read is that may be correct, that the Hatch Act applies to federal employees, but perhaps not to the president. But then I also read an analysis where the idea, if he gave the speech inside the White House, you would have federal employees preparing for that and helping him put this together. So that might be a violation.
Because the Hatch Act prohibits partisan political activity by a federal employee in a government room or a building or any room or building occupied in the discharge of official duties. So that would clearly put federal employees who work at the White House in violation of the Hatch Act. But White House Chief of Staff and former North Carolina Congressman Mark Meadows told CNN's Wolf Blitzer that most of the White House is fair game.
If you're talking about coming to them from the Oval Office, obviously that's an official place. But part of the House is, as you probably, well, you do know, Wolf, part of the House is official. As we look at that, that's where we conduct business. Then you go over into the East Wing, and that's the private residence. And so doing those kinds of things that would be more political in nature from the East Wing is certainly an appropriate place to do it if he chooses to do that.
Of course, this would be another incidence of pushing the envelope and breaking with traditions that have been national norms by this administration. And Mark Meadows told Fox and Friends, or the president told Fox and Friends, that he would change his plan of having it in the White House if, quote, anyone had a problem with it. So is this just a trial balloon floated to see what kind of reaction this might get, or some sort of a diversionary tactic to bring attention and the spotlight back to the White House and the president?
Well, first of all, Mike, I just want to say I'm shocked that there would be a change in Republican National Convention planning, because it seems like it's been so consistent all along. I'm not sure if it's a trial balloon or a diversionary tactic, but I would just remind everybody that it was a little bit over a week ago that the president was in the Triangle assuring people that he would be making his speech in North Carolina. So these things can change rapidly.
Well, believe it or not, during all of this, the pandemic and the convention and everything else that's been screwed up by the coronavirus, Hurricane Isaias made landfall near North Carolina's Ocean Isle Beach late on Monday night. At landfall, winds were clocked at 85 miles per hour, and Spectrum News 1 anchor reporter Jonathan Lowe has been covering the damage and the recovery from the hurricane most of this week, and he joins us now. You look pretty sleepy, Jonathan. Where was most of the damage concentrated?
It was all along the North Carolina coast. I mean, dare anybody say just because this was not a Cat 2 or Cat 3 hurricane, it flirted with, I think it re-strengthened to a hurricane right before it made landfall down at near Ocean Isle Beach, right at the south coast, right at north of the South Carolina line. Yeah. But I mean, it spawned, I think the count is now 6 tornadoes that touched down. So all the way up the North Carolina coast.
And I think I'm correct in saying that the biggest of those tornadoes hit Burdick County, which is where an F3 tornado hit a mobile home park. It killed two people there. And the Burdick County sheriff described the destruction as unreal.
I've been with the sheriff's office for 38 years, and I know the mobile home park, and it's like nothing is there.
That tornado hit at 1:15 in the morning, with wind speeds of between 140 and 145 miles per hour. Aside from that EF3 tornado, Was most of the damage due to wind, or did surf and beach erosion and storm surge play a role in the damage?
So as far as Bertie County, it was the tornado. Down at Ocean Isle Beach, I think it was more so storm surge and wind damage. I mean, they were hit hard at Ocean Isle Beach. But as far as Bertie County, and I was out there on the ground, and that tornado was on the ground for, I believe it was 10, 11 miles. And if people could think about, that's from Uptown Charlotte to Matthews is about that distance. Jeez. It was on the ground in EF3 tornado, I think 145 mile an hour winds. That mobile home park was pulverized, flattened. So, you know, two people killed, but they're, you know, this hit in the middle of the night, Mike. So with the pandemic, a lot of people are at home. Right. And so shelters were available, but, you know, just you think with the pandemic, people probably weren't going to do that. So it hits in the middle of the night. One good thing is that the state has a search and rescue task force. And so when the governor institute or put that declaration of emergency last Thursday, I believe, it activated that search and rescue team. And so they were out there prior to the storm hitting. So when it did hit, they were right on it, but the storm was passing over. It was the dead of night, no power anywhere, people screaming that were trapped. It was pretty a harrowing story, just tragic what happened.
And in the Brunswick County town of Ocean Isle Beach, fires erupted during the hurricane.
Absolutely.
And then later on, several days afterward. Quickly, what's the story there? Why?
So with all the power outages and the power lines that were down, it started sparking fires and homes just all along Ocean Isle Beach. So in addition to the wind damage that was inland, you had, you know, several homes. I don't know the count now. Yep. It just kept happening. What the storm hit Tuesday night, and still by, you know, Wednesday, late Wednesday, they were still having fires.
Jonathan Lowe, who was on the ground along the coast in the aftermath of the hurricane earlier this week, thank you for joining us. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One, thank you.
Absolutely.
This week, a federal judge refused to order several changes to the state's election rules sought by Democracy North Carolina, Steve, and the League of Women Voters of North Carolina, who are worried about how COVID-19 might impact voting. They were specifically concerned about absentee mail-in ballots, and they told U.S. District Judge William Osteen that 15% of absentee mail-in ballots were rejected in the March primary. So what did they ask for, and what was the judge's ruling, and why?
So they wanted a lot more kind of liberal and open rules for early voting. They didn't get many of those from the judge, but they did get one big thing, which is that if your mail ballot is rejected for a technicality, like not having enough witness signatures or maybe a wrong address, you get a chance to fix that. So that's a pretty big deal. Now, in Mecklenburg County, they've done that before. If they get your ballot in time, they will send it back to you if there's a problem. I think what's going to be a big interesting thing this year is you're going to have so many thousands of mail ballots coming in. Are you going to be able to fix your ballot after Election Day? And no one knows.
They also asked for the elimination of uniform early voting hours, the traditional voter registration deadline 25 days before Election Day, and the witness requirement. Plus, they wanted a method for people to request absentee ballots by phone and to leave completed ballots in no contact boxes. All of those requests were denied. Why?
I think a thing to remember is that the Board of Elections has already made some changes to early voting to make it easier. Perhaps not as far as some people want, but remember, with mail voting, you used to have two witness signatures. Now you only need one. So I think the judge felt that was enough.
WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison, Katie Peralta, senior editor for Charlotte Agenda, Glenn Birkins, reporter and founder of QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. I leave you with this. A friend of mine sent me this yesterday, so I can't attribute it to anyone, but a fact is information minus emotion. An opinion is information plus experience. Ignorance is an opinion lacking information. And stupidity is an opinion that ignores facts. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.